Morning, council. This is the case of Cheney versus Evan. As you can see, five members of the court are here in the courtroom. Two members of the court are on WebEx. That would be Justice Miller Norman and Justice Funk. You can't see them on that screen. I apologize. We've had technology problems this morning. You can see them on the screen over here. So when you're arguing, you will be able to see them. You may have to crane your neck a little bit, but they will be participating just as if they were in the courtroom, and the bailiff is just helping you a little bit. We can probably help you a little bit more.
Good morning. This is Justice Miller Lerman. As the chief has said, Justice Funk and I are participating WebEx, and we can see the council. Thanks.
Very good morning. I think we have the television now situated a little bit better, so you can better see those two justices. When you are not arguing, please keep your masks on if at all possible. When you are arguing, please take your mask off so that we can hear and understand what you have to say. Are there any questions before we begin? Thank you very much. We will begin then. Mr. Lockbaugh, good morning to you. You may approach and you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'd first like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor. I represent the appellant in this matter, Cheney. The timeline of all this is important, and I'd like to start with that. We requested copies of the petition, commonly known as the payday lending petition, in July, and again in writing July 31st. We were told that they would be available soonest by the Secretary of State August 10th. They're actually provided to us August 11th. The Secretary of State announced that the matter had been certified August 5th. The appellant and others began meeting with signers and obtained 188 withdrawals from people who said, in effect, they were not read the object statement and did not understand what the petition did and did not want their signature to remain on it. This matter was filed 20 short days later, August 31st. There were 188 withdrawals attached to the complaint, and by the time we had the hearing on the temporary injunction, that total had risen to 237, which is represented by Exhibit 2. As I indicated, there was a motion for temporary injunction, there was a motion to dismiss, or in the alternative for summary judgment, and a motion to continue, all heard on September 8th. The court ruled on the 9th, dismissing the matter, and finding that there was no possibility that we could amend to state a cause of action herein.
Did you ask for leave to amend?
Not at that hearing, no, we did not.
Did you ever ask for leave to amend?
Not after the dismissal, no. I mean, there were no other hearings, so I guess not at that hearing, we did not ask, and we appealed that order of dismissal.
There was no motion after that order asking?
No, there was not. The basis of the court's ruling was that the court read Section 32-628 of the Nebraska Revised Statutes to not require that the object statement be read to each potential signer by the circulator. We believe that is plain error and also noted error, I guess. The language states in 32-628-3 that each circulator has to attest that he or she, among other things, stated to each signer the object of the petition as printed on the petition. That can only mean one thing, the appellant contends, and that is you have to read the object statement on the petition as it is stated there. It would be one thing.
Has this court ever interpreted that language?
I could find no authority, Your Honor. I don't think anyone else could either. There was the court cited another Lancaster District Court decision from 2009 by Judge Flowers, holding that circulators were free to summarize what the object of the petition was. And we think that opens a Pandora's box to what is an adequate summary. In whose eyes is it an adequate summary? We view the provisions of the statute requiring that the object statement be read as kind of a safe harbor for the circulators, for everyone involved.
Suppose, counsel, you had a recording of what was actually read or stated, and the recording showed that it read every word except it omitted an article such as the, said everything except that one word in the middle, the.
I could see a circumstance where the court would find some sort of substantial compliance with that, just a sort of a rule of reason that would not be something that material change.
Yes. If substantial compliance is the standard, what's the best argument that there wasn't substantial compliance here?
Well, in the we introduced Exhibit 1, which was the affidavit of Powers. He had people telling him, he was one of the people approaching the prior signers, and had one tell him, I was just told it would lower my property taxes. I don't think that's substantial compliance. I can't conceive of a reality where if this thing passed, it would somehow lower people's property taxes.
You mentioned Exhibit 1, but the district court, as I read its order, dismissed this on the pleadings. They granted the 12B6 motion for failure to state a claim.
That's correct.
But it does seem like there was some evidence offered at the hearing.
That's correct.
Did this get converted to a motion for summary judgment, or was it decided as a motion to dismiss?
And the court said it decided as a motion to dismiss. It was argued as the three things: motion for temporary injunction, motion for summary judgment, actually motion to dismiss, or in the alternative, motion for summary judgment.
But you haven't, correct me if I'm wrong, but you haven't assigned error to the district court's treating as a motion to dismiss. You haven't said the district court erred by not converting it to a motion for summary judgment.
No, we said they erred in granting the motion to dismiss.
So you're fighting on the 12B6 grounds.
That's correct.
So if you're fighting on the 12B6 grounds, what does Exhibit 1 have to do with it? Exhibit 1's outside the complaint.
That is surely correct. But it is additional evidence in responding to the justice's question about what evidence or what would be substantial compliance versus not substantial compliance, if you will.
The 32.628, the affidavit doesn't have to say, the circulator affidavit, it doesn't have to say exactly the words in 32.628, does it?
Well, it says the statement as printed on the petition.
Well, I'm talking about the language that says the affidavit shall be in substantially the following form, and then it lists what has to be listed. So even the circulator affidavit doesn't have to be exactly what appears in the form affidavit in 32.628.3, correct?
I think if the legislature went through the effort to detail in the form as stated on the petition, that is really the only safe harbor we can apply here. Otherwise, we're going to have, well, as it happened in this case, a lowering property tax. Summarizing all of a sudden becomes in the eye of a beholder.
But we're obligated to give effect to the affidavit shall be in substantially the following form, don't we? I mean, the legislature could have said the affidavit must say exactly this, and they chose substantially.
They did insert the word substantially. We believe that also there will be an argument, there has been an argument, that it is unconstitutional for the legislature to have attached this onto the process, the requirement that the statement be read. And there are holdings from this court, in the Stenberg case in particular, that legislature has the inherent authority to prevent fraud in this process, and anti-fraud statutes, such as this one, requiring that the statement be presented to the potential signer, facilitate, not hamper, but facilitate the initiative and petition process. So this is clearly something within the legislature's ambit of preventing fraud by requiring this statement to have been read. The legislature has done other things, like requiring that the sponsors file a sworn affidavit with their names and address on it, so you know who's behind the petition ostensibly. And has actually, this court has thrown out cases, or petitions, I should say, that did not comply with that sponsor statement requirement. And again, the court found that there, if it is an anti-fraud provision, it's not meant to, in that case, and in this we would argue, inhibit the initiative and petition process. It is meant to enhance it and make it function as it should.
If one supposes that this circulator said, as you suggest, this will lower your property taxes, but the person who signed read the form and understood what he or she was reading and signed it anyway, would fraud exist or could fraud exist under those circumstances?
That would, I understand it's a hypothetical. What we found was most of these signers that we talked to did not independently read the petition themselves. And the trial court did seize upon that and say, you haven't, it is presumed that if you sign something, you've read it. We would argue that that was a mistaken application of the law when there is a statute out there that says circulators read this, the statement as printed on the petition.
Counsel, you have substituted the word read for the statutory text of stated several times in your argument. Is that what you're asking us to do in this case? Substitute the term read for the statutory term stated?
No, Your Honor, that was imprecise language on my part. It does say stated, not read.
Is there a difference between reading and stating?
I would argue that the language that says you must state it as it is printed on the petition means you pretty much have to read it.
Is that just a summary? To state something as it's printed on the petition?
I would say no. That says you read the words on the petition. I don't see how that would lead to a summary being okay. And again, the problem with summaries would be, where does it end? We would have as many different summaries as there are circulators and as many of those as there are days in the week. And how would we ever have any confidence that people who sign these petitions have any idea what they're actually signing?
Is there a difference between stating and reciting?
If there's a subtle difference between the two, it is lost in me.
A statement and a recitation.
I would say a recitation would be something from memory. I don't know material how different from a statement in this point. If you have to state it as is printed on the petition, I think you have to state the words on the petition.
But you would prefer this court to define stated to mean read verbatim?
Yes. Again, there is the possibility of missing an A or a B, but if you allow this to go the direction the trial court did, there's really no standard at all. You would have as many possible summaries as there are circulators and signers and days in the week.
So is your request that we substitute read substantially verbatim for the text of the statute?
I believe that as the statute is written, they're supposed to state it as it is printed on the petition.
I wonder if I could backtrack just a little bit with respect to Justice Papik's question, and that is, what's on deck here? Did we have a ruling that there was a failure to state a cause of action? Do we have a ruling that the case is moot? If any of those things were found to be correct by this court, would we proceed to any of these statutory interpretation issues that you now raise?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. That is what is before the court, is that the motion to dismiss. But it was based upon the statutory interpretation issue. And the mootness argument, we believe that simply does not apply here. And there is litigation on that as well in the past, and holdings in this court. I don't know if it's pronounced Duggan or Dugan, where the actual time for the temporary injunction had passed, it was denied, the ballots were printed, but the court still did weigh in on a declaratory judgment saying that the proper number of signatures had not been gathered, so the petitions were insufficient. And I think that's the circumstance we have here. The lower court's finding that simply because the affidavits attached stated that the statement was not stated to the signer, since he found that was not required, then there was no way we could amend. We contend that is error, because taken take the pleadings taken as they are stated, and actually the additional evidence that came up at the trial, hearing, I should say, suggests that there are other ways we could substantiate fraud or insufficiency of these petitions. So the dismissal with no leave to amend being possible, we believe is error.
The statute regarding the procedure for removal of the name, 32.632, refers to presenting an affidavit for removal prior to or on the day the petition is filed for verification with the election commissioner or county clerk. Would you agree that the record is pretty clear in this case that none of the affidavits in this case were presented on or before that date?
Yes, Your Honor, it's certainly clear it was an impossibility to do that. For the reason previously stated, we did not receive copies of the petitions from the Secretary of State's office, despite requesting them, until after this had been certified.
So you're relying not on the procedural statute, but on fraud?
Yes, Your Honor. And the admittedly older decision of Barclay v. Poole that talks about if a circulator is impeached, all of his petitions would be suspect as well. And that allows for...
That case, as I understood it, was premised upon until the action had been taken by the county superintendent. By the time that this was brought, hadn't the action been taken by the election commissioner or county clerk in all the jurisdictions?
Yes. I think it was an impossibility to do otherwise. We didn't know who had signed until we had the petition.
That citation to the old case seems to me to have a little bit of a problem. And I'd like if you have a response to that, because your brief didn't address that aspect. If you have a response, I'd like to hear it.
There definitely is a factual distinction there in that way. That case we also cited more for the proposition that once you've impeached the credibility of a circulator on one petition, if you will, all of the petitions he or she submitted fall as well. So while we had a limited number of withdrawals attached to the complaint, if you look at what circulators were implicated in those actions, and again, the evidence is still being gathered as far as we're still contacting other people who have signed this thing and finding out other things about what they were told. All of that would then come down to attacking the credibility of the oaths of these circulators, which could render thousands of these signatures invalid as a result.
Assume we let this go forward, reverse the district court. Don't we still have a deadline that after, once the election occurred and the votes were certified, wouldn't this be moved at that point?
Not under the Dugan case or Duggan case. Again, I apologize. I'm not sure the proper pronunciation.
That goes back to my question about what Duggan stands for.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I thought we were talking about the Barclay decision.
Yes, you're correct.
My fault. But in Duggan, the temporary injunction was not granted. So the item in question, the petition, appeared on the ballot. The election had been had, and the court still ruled that if you violate the petition process itself, the voters put the restrictions in the Constitution on themselves by passing the restrictions in the Constitution as far as how you do a petition. So a vote after the fact doesn't sanitize, even the past, it doesn't sanitize the fact that the process was wrong on the front end. So it doesn't become moot even if the election has happened, if on the front end the initiative process was flawed or insufficient in some way.
Was your case brought to the declaratory judgment action?
Not currently, Your Honor, but it would be a proper amendment now that we're past the injunction. I'll be honest that when this was filed, I received the complaint one business day before I filed it. They had only had 20 days to gather their signatures, and we were trying to move forward with the temporary injunction as fast as we could with the September 11th deadline approaching for ballot certification. So we got it on file. And amending it to request a declaratory judgment would be proper, I believe, Your Honor. As such, we would just request that this matter be returned to the district court, that amendment be allowed, and that the dismissal be overruled.
Thank you very much. Mr. Post, good morning to you. Are you going to share your time?
Good morning, and yes, we will. Approximately 10 minutes and 10 minutes.
Thank you very much. Now, the bailiff does not make that cut off, you know.
Understood.
It's up to you.
May it please the court. It is simply too late for the injunction that Cheney requested. There's a big distinction between the Barkley case in the 1919 and now. The election's already occurred. Election day is not the day that actually matters anymore. People have already voted. People started voting about 2 weeks ago. I voted yesterday. The election's already occurring, so the injunction is already moved. Again, as this court noted, there is no request for declaratory relief in the complaint. It was not mentioned in the district court. It wasn't mentioned until for the first time in the reply brief on appeal.
Is there a general prayer for equitable relief?
There is, but I still think you need to bring it up. I mean, I think it would be a surprise at this point to the district judge that declaratory relief was on the table. It was a surprise to us again until the reply brief.
Is that something that would be the proper subject of an amendment to the complaint?
If leave was requested and if they could show it wasn't futile, then I think you could, in just general, amend to add a request for declaratory relief. The issue here, though, is you have to have layers of finding abuse of discretion. So you'll remember that even hearing a declaratory judgment in the first place is up to the discretion of the trial court. And then you have the layer of whether or not the denial of leave to amend is an abuse of discretion. So you'd have to show multiple layers of abuse of discretion, which, again, were not raised and are not assigned as error in this instance.
Have we ever ruled that the court has an obligation sua sponte to suggest the party amend?
I'm not aware of that.
Thank you.
Again, so even if we're taking up the declaratory relief question at all, and there were some questions on that, this court said as recently as Stewart versus Heineman that declaratory relief is supposed to be forward-looking. It's preemptive justice. And it equated it to an injunction. Of course, it's not the same, but it was mentioned in the same paragraph as an example. So the election's already occurring. There is no preemptive justice that can occur here. Now, we know that Duggan versus Spearman 1 says what it says. I can't change that. I do think, though, it is distinguishable in a couple of ways. First, both of the Duggan cases involved constitutional challenges. The court was very specific that they were not addressing a sufficiency signature challenge. They repeated that multiple times. They actually said that Duggan did not contest the quality or the number submitted, just the number that was required under the Constitution. And even then, the court noted that substantial compliance, and paraphrasing, but could apply to prevent voiding the initiative that failed to meet the signature requirement but was approved by the voters. But that wasn't the facts of that case. So although I recognize that the Duggan case did allow voiding an initiative after the fact, there are factual differences there, and the application of the constitutional provision we submit should make a difference. On the timely withdrawal question, the legislature set up a system. Ultimately, the window you have is set by the legislature. It's probably a practical point. The signatures are due at a certain point in time. The signatures are then sent off to the counties at a certain point in time. It makes sense that the legislature said that within that window, however short, you need to withdraw before we send all these counties off to go check all the signatures. And so to the extent the window was particularly short in this instance, that's just a product of the policy choice made by the legislature. And as my brief pointed out, the request for the signatures here that the other side wants to continue to focus on came way after the deadline had already passed. So that's a bit of a red herring.
Does the withdrawal statute 32632, do you understand that to apply to instances in which individuals want to withdraw their signatures because of fraud?
We would say yes, and I would distinguish the Dauphin case that's cited in the brief, the Dauphin, however you say that. The case doesn't actually say you get to withdraw later based on fraud. So the case is generally referencing it's the point that was made earlier, which is whatever your right to withdraw is, okay, you can't do it after the petition has been acted on. So even if the principle from that case did stand for what was cited for and did apply, the petition has been acted on here. The election is occurring. So that's how that Dauphin case is distinguishable. And to the question of what guards against fraud, if we're looking at the object statement, what guards against fraud here and making sure that the signer knows what they're signing is all of the other requirements of what has to be on the petition itself. Now, we understand that people may not read the petition, but the information was available to them to read if they saw fit or if they thought the circulator was not telling them the whole story or something along those lines. Another thing that's in the statute that guards against fraud that doesn't involve wiping out all the otherwise valid signatures are the criminal penalties for the petition circulator. And so, given the bevy of options to address fraud that the legislature has presented, we think the narrow reading on object statement to require that it be read verbatim is basically reading that statute too restrictive of the right of initiative, especially considering all the other ways in regard against fraud. And we cited in our brief the Stenberg versus Moore case, where an exact signature match was not required, and they basically apply the substantial compliance.
So what are you arguing that language in 32.628, the object of the petition as printed on the petition, what are you arguing that means?
We're arguing that the only way it can be interpreted is in a constitutional manner, and to do so, it has to allow some flexibility in stating the object. Of course, it cannot be misleading, but I don't think it would further the right of the initiative to say that an otherwise valid signature is thrown out because the circulator didn't say the word thought. And so it doesn't say you have to read it verbatim. It doesn't say you have to read it at all. It just says state, and there was a discussion earlier about what that means. And so I think the only constitutional way to read that is to allow a non-misleading summary of the object.
So to use your opponent's example, if the circulator said this, the object is to lower your property tax, where are we?
So if that happened, first of all, then the opponents would be aware of an allegation of fraud far in advance, so they could have raised it and allowed for more evidentiary development at that point, right? Secondly, if that happened under the test I gave, I think that would be something that the district court should look at, right? If you actually had that allegation. As this court noted just a little while ago, you don't have that allegation here. You have one piece of evidence that at most applied to one signature with layers of hearsay in that piece of evidence. And so we just don't think it meets that threshold. There was no showing in the district court that amendment would not be futile. This is not the Barclay case where you have thousands of signatures that are coming in from people who are no longer alive and all sorts of
and this stuff. This dovetails then with your argument about the specificity of pleading required?
Yes, it does. And Mr. Laughlin's going to address that in more detail, but it does. Of course, the Secretary of State would be concerned about fraud in the initiative process. But there has to be some room for circulators and signers to follow all of these requirements and still keep the right of initiative in place. And
if this court, I beg your pardon, if this court were to find the based on the existing pleadings that the matter was moot, would we have any reason or should there be applied the public interest exception or something to that effect to explore what it means under 32.628.3 with where the circulators state the object? Would we go on to interpret or state the meaning of that in this case?
So I don't think the public interest exception would apply specifically here. This actually doesn't come up very often, as this court's seen from the docket. I believe it's only the second case on this particular type of object statement challenge. This isn't the ballot title case we just had, but this is coming up regularly. And so, obviously the public interest exception is a bit flexible, but I don't think this is the sort of case where the court needs to weigh in on that specific question directly if the case is otherwise moved.
Thank you.
There are no further questions. Ready for Mr. Waffle?
Thank you very much. Mr. Waffle, good morning to you. You may proceed.
Before I turn to the allegations of fraud, I'll pick up Justice Castle's statutory interpretation that obviously you all will make your own call on. But for example, the words as printed on the petition, they don't come after stated. It doesn't say state what's printed on the petition. It talks about state the object of the petition as printed on the petition. So I throw out that there could be an argument that as printed on the petition modifies is describing the petition itself rather than demanding what needs to be stated. And my other response, Justice Castle, is that even if you say that the object of the petition as printed needs to be stated, then the question becomes, what does that stated mean, which gets to questions that were promulgated to the appellant's counsel by Justice Stacy. So that's at least one answer to your plain analysis of the text question. Turning to fraud, what they allege, and they have a spreadsheet, attached to their complaint. So we had to get 5% of the registered voters in 38 Nebraska counties. And we went out, we got 126,000 signatures, we had 46 counts. And so what they did, and again, this is attached to their complaint, is they said, okay, how many registered voters are there in that county on an Excel spreadsheet? And then they said, what's 5% of that? Then they had another column that said, what's the delta? Like, how many do we have to knock out? What's the delta? And then they sorted those deltas by the smallest and put them up top. And so they figured out what's the least number of votes that we can knock out to turn this from a W win to an L loss for the initiative sponsors.
So what?
Then, because what they did to do that, that's a fair question. Here's the so what. So what they did and what they pled is they went out with a form affidavit with one, I'm going to generally loosely call it a representation. And because their backdrop is the statute requires it to be read word for word, the so what is the only thing that they got these people to abide to is that they didn't read every single word. The example, okay? I sneezed during the word the. I was trying to read the whole thing. That's completely consistent with what their representation was. And so it's the only, I've been practicing law in Nebraska for 28 years, and this is the first fraud claim that I've seen where the actual misrepresentation, what was actually misrepresented, what was said, or what was omitted is left silent, is hidden, is not alleged. It would be like this. Let's say I bought a house from a seller, and a month after I found a spot of mold in a corner of an attic. And so I allege the seller didn't tell me every single thing about the house, and I found mold, give me my money back. Question, Mr. Laughlin, are you saying that the seller told you there was no mold? No. Are you saying that the seller knew about the mold? No. Are you saying that the seller intended to deceive you and trick you into buying this house? No. Hey, read my complaint. The seller did not tell me everything about the house. And my contention, the so what, is that my argument to you all is that what was alleged in this complaint is legally identical to that in my hypothetical, that I think would be a much easier or clearer call. Well, wait a minute, you can't do that. That's not a fraud claim. You've got to say something more. You've got to allege that you were trying to be tricked. You have to allege specifically what was said to you or what was not. And they haven't done that.
Aren't the appellants, the fraud that they're identifying is not fraud on circulator to signer. It's fraud on circulator to Secretary of State, correct?
Thank you. And that's the second point, Justice Papik, that I want, the key point that I wanted to make in this argument, which is the only fraud that is legally relevant is exactly, my argument is exactly that, the fraud between me, if I'm a circulator, and you, if you're a signer. And anything that I do afterward, it can't undo it. So, for example, let's say I come to you, Justice Papik, and I said, here's our payday lending, and I read it, and you sign it, and it's all good. But then afterward, for whatever reason, I say, you know what, I don't like the initiative sponsors, or you know what, I don't like Justice Papik, and I don't want his vote to count. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take some action afterward. I'm going to say, you know, I told Justice Papik it was about, he's going to get $1,000 back every year. And I sign an affidavit, and I commit fraud. That can't undo your signature. The only fraud that matters is the fraud, is alleged fraud, during the conversation that they had. And their complaint conflates those two. And the other thing I would add, and this also gets to one of your comments that you made to the appellant's lawyer, Justice Papik, is this, you know, there's not a, this statute doesn't say there's a requirement necessary, a direct requirement that the circulator state the object of the petition. It says there has to be someone who signs an affidavit that says that, and it provides a penalty if that's not done. And that penalty is a class four felony for a fraudulent circulator. Nowhere in here do they say, and then you throw out the signatures. Nowhere in there. So I completely agree, and that was the second point that I wanted to leave with all of you. There's a big difference between alleged fraud in the actual obtaining of the signature and fraud at any other time, any other place in the world, which we argue is legally irrelevant in all cases. And the other point that I wanted to make before I run out of time is in the Stenberg, in the State v. Stenberg case, this court, and you all have are I'm sure initiative out. There's been a lot of cases this year, of which maybe this will be the last. It's the third payday lending one we've had. But you said in that voter case that the legislation which even hampers or renders ineffective the power reserved to the people is unconstitutional. Yes, the legislature can pass statutes which address fraud, but it has to be narrow. It can't be overbroad or it's unconstitutional. It can't hamper the process. And I just throw out to you that here it is. It's a heavy, heavy lift to get an initiative passed. You need a lot of money and you need a lot of people who are willing to give their time and donate their time. And you have to span across this state and get signatures from a whole bunch of different places. And so, yes, we all sit here in the hallowed halls and have these arguments, but what you haven't seen is all the work and how hard it is to actually do that. And now to say, this is really kind of goes to a statutory interpretation. Think about what a heavy burden it would be to that every one of those circulators and every one of those voters have to read every single word. And if really the law in Nebraska, if all you had to do was, hey, we'll let the payday lending people go out and spend their money and get 126,000 signatures. And then guess what? It's great. All we have to do is go out and get 200 signatures, say the word fraud a couple of times in a complaint, and we're good to go. Then there's an existential threat. And they got to hire expensive lawyers, which they may or may not afford. That is the definition, I'm arguing, of hampering, of what would hamper the initiative process and, frankly, create a Pandora's box of kind of single subject rule type litigation. If that's all you have to do, well, that's a no-brainer. Anybody can do that.
Why did the legislature put in a system to take your name off?
Because they wanted people to do that. And And they can do that. But the whole point, and frankly, Your Honor, this started off as a withdrawal signature case, but when we pointed out the statute, there was a pretty quick pivot, and the discussion in the district court was on the general fraud claims. Because we have to turn in our signatures by a certain date. And so it can't be, that's why the legislature says, hey, we're not going to allow a gotcha. You can't come in, we're not going to allow people to go out and get 188 after that. We can't do anything. And so that's why the legislature did it. But it's got to be timely. And everybody agrees that these withdrawals aren't timely under that statute. The question is a general fraud, and Justice Packard's point of how those two interplay.
If we agree with you that the district court properly dismissed for failure to state a claim, we still have the assignment of error that leave to amend should have been granted. Could you respond to that with particular reference to the one exhibit we have where maybe we're getting closer to circulator to signer misrepresentations?
Yes. First of all, they didn't ask, they didn't request it at any time, but I understand your question. That affidavit, which we got about 2 hours before the hearing, is one affidavit that has about three layers of hearsay in it. You can see it in the record. And it's one. And I would argue, Justice Papik, that even if they had that one allegation, that's not enough. Maybe it's enough to invalidate one signature. Maybe. But I just cannot believe. The other thing, Justice Papik, is they would have to fraud claim. That's the misrepresentation. Well, you have to prove that someone intended to deceive you. You have to prove that you relied on it. There's other allegations. And so I don't think that one triple hearsay 11th hour affidavit that we didn't even really see. We didn't really know about when we were talking. When we were going until halfway through the hearing, I don't think that's safe. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 1 minute and 48 seconds.
1 minute and 48 seconds, Mr. Lockwell.
May it please the court. One thing you did not hear today was why on earth it is onerous in any way to simply read the object statement. I can guarantee you that is the assumption that most petition drives have moved forward with. Those are the instructions from the Secretary of State's office. Read the object statement. As we argued before, this is the ultimate safe harbor. Just read the statement on the petition. No one has articulated why that is somehow undoable, or that is somehow a burden on the petition process to have the circulators read that statement to the people they want to sign it. It seems like it would be beneficial for both sides for that to be the rule. Then you have a rule, simply put. As far as the questioning or distinguishing of the Duggan case involving a constitutional challenge, not the quality of the signatures, that's true, it's a factual difference, but that doesn't really change the underlying analysis. That this would not be moot, even if the election, even if voting has already started, even if the voting were concluded, the votes were tabulated, Duggan was still not moot. So that really does not change, we would argue, the meaningfulness of that holding for this matter. There was a talk of fairness on the appellees. It is difficult to imagine how a petition would ever be reviewed for fraud, for not reading the statement in any way based upon the timeline urged by the other side. We asked July 31st, we'd asked previously, we put a records request in writing July 31st and got the petitions at the earliest August 11th.
But signatories could have withdrawn before that, right?
I mean, individually.
Your argument is sort of premised on that opponents to the ballot initiative have to have some way to sort of organize a campaign to contact people and say, did you really want to sign this? Hasn't the legislature made a policy choice that you know, there's a window for signatories to withdraw, and there wasn't anything that precluded that from happening here, is there?
There was nothing precluding the individuals, but we would submit that the opponents to a petition drive do have the right to review them and do have the right to bring this evidence forward and try to point out if there was wrongdoing in the petition drive. And again, it happened as soon as it could possibly happen. When the Secretary of State produced the names, we found out and tried to find out what had gone on. And in 20 days, we had the complaint on file. It is true we went out to the remote counties and with the smaller populations because such an effort in Douglas County would be difficult. It's ongoing now, but it'd be difficult. But there has to be some mechanism, and I see I'm out of time, I apologize. There has to be some mechanism to look into what was done here by the opponents to this and verify whether or not the petition should validly be on the ballot. And I apologize, I see I'm out of time.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments on Cheney versus Edmund. Council, please properly distance yourselves and wear masks as you leave the courtroom. And please leave the courtroom by this side door to my left. Thank you very much.